Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good evening. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to this podcast. We will be interviewing once again Mr. Greg Johnson, the CEO of WebCheck Security. They're one of the top pen testing firms on the West Coast based out of Utah. Greg, thanks for joining us tonight. We're going to be talking about a hot button topic which is affecting all European companies and even those U.S. companies that have offices in Europe, and that is called the GDPR. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Ravi, and happy New Year to you, too, and to all your listeners. You're doing a great job in building a cybersecurity virtual empire with all of these great podcasts, the book you're co-authoring. You're just doing some great things. It's an honor to be affiliated with you.
Thank you, Greg. Same here. And I got to do a plug in. Greg is also the co-author for our book on web application security. That should be coming out in print, hopefully by May or by the latest by June. So thanks, Greg. Let's get down. Let's get to it.
Sure.
Excuse me. Now, everybody pretty much in cybersecurity or even non-cybersecurity has heard of these four letters, actually, GDPR. Now, what is the definition of it, and where does it come from? Can you please educate our audience into that?
Absolutely. So getting right into it, GDPR stands for the General Data Protection Regulation, and it was implemented by the European Union to protect all European citizens with regards to the use of their sensitive information. And I'm actually going to go back, Ravi, and if I may, correct something that you said
please.
Earlier. You mentioned that it's for the protection of European citizens' data and for companies operating in Europe or U.S. companies operating in Europe. But the reality is you get any U.S. company, and let me give you an example of that, a large hotel chain. You can think of a dozen of them off the top of your head, from Hilton to Marriott to whatever. And because there may be thousands of European citizens patronizing their businesses, they are touching European business. Also, Ravi, think in terms of service providers. Let's say that Amazon, for example, AWS, that they are hosting data for companies that are operating in the European Union. Now, boom, here we have a U.S. company that everybody knows about, and it is now in scope for GDPR simply because it's touching or servicing other companies that service the data of European citizens. So not only am I defining that GDPR stands for the General Data Protection Regulation and it has to do with the private information of European citizens, but it really applies to any service provider or business entity that touches companies that touch the data or that service them. Anything that could lead to a breach of sensitive data, for example, and we'll get into this in the podcast, but information associated with their personal address, email address, religious affiliations and things of that nature. So just to start off the podcast, Ravi, on the right note, GDPR really is more expansive and touches more companies in the U.S. than I think a lot of people are anticipating. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah.
So where did it come from? If I may, let me expand a little bit on that. Is that okay?
Yeah, please do. Please enlighten us as much as possible because this is I was writing a blog, no, not a blog, but I was reading somewhere, and I actually put a post on the site in our cybersecurity forum that this is going to be like the GDPR and the California Privacy Act are going to be like the two most powerful, I guess, data privacy acts around the world. They're being enforced right now. So please, please, please enlighten our audience about this.
Yeah, and good insight on that too. And we will talk a little bit during this podcast about the CCPA as well, because there are a lot of similarities. So GDPR basically was adopted on April 27th of 2016, And it replaces the Data Protection Directive that was a previous directive protecting European citizens' data, and obviously it unifies or codifies all of the existing privacy regulations, and now it takes precedence over those. It expands basically the control that citizens have over their own personal data, and we'll talk about this throughout the podcast, but the right to be deleted, the right to be forgotten, the right to know where your data is going and who's using it. The GDPR came into full implementation just this past year, Ravi, so it's still new. We still don't understand, I think, the full implications of it. And I guess this year I'm still thinking of 2019. It actually came into play May 25th of 2018. I'm behind the times. But we're still understanding, trying to understand what it meant in 2019 and then what it's going to mean going forward in 2020. But, you know, you look at the GDPR and how European nations were able to come together to create not only this regulation, but the governing body, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But one would wonder, well, why are Europeans leading the way in this? Why are they so sensitive to this? And this may be personal opinion. I've heard this said by a good privacy lawyer friend of mine, Matt Sorensen, fantastic guy, works for a cyber company called Formidify, which is owned by Parsons, Bailey and Latimer of Salt Lake City. And I heard Matt say once, you know, the Holocaust was a great kind of catalyst for this, because when you think about it, everybody understands and acknowledges that it was a horrible event, a tragedy in world history, and hence Europeans in particular are very sensitive to who knows what about me and is my religious affiliation publicly available. I don't want it to be publicly available, perhaps, and can I not have control over who's making decisions about me, who has my data, et cetera. And so I, you know, in Matt's opinion and in my opinion, that was probably, you know, if you look at the history, that's why Europeans are leading the way. They are, rightly so, I suppose, very sensitive about control over their own data. And that, of course, has, I think, been one of the catalysts in the California Privacy Act and other states that are looking to enact privacy as well. And then, Ravi, there's been some catalysts, too, over the years. You look at some of the giants of the industry in social media, such as Facebook, and gathering data and sending it to organizations such as Cambridge Analytica. And you remember the big fiasco over the large data breach and what that meant for you and I, who, you know, anybody who has a Facebook account. And so they're, you know, based on the sensitivity to data, based on history, and based on catalysts like Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, I think that has all led us to today in 2020, where now we have not only robust directives that are coming into play, but you're going to see more of this as time goes on, if that makes sense.
Okay. You know, Greg, I really thought the GDPR was implemented in full force actually last year, or did it just come out in phases last year?
Well, I think it's really two phase. It really became law, if you will. So in other words, if you're found in breach of the law anytime after May 25th of 2018, then there potentially could be measures taken, and we'll talk about those measures or penalties against a company. But I think there was a grace period as well. You probably didn't see some of the major fines come into play until this past year, and you know, we'll go over some of those. But I think they will become in 2020 now. You know, it's like the honeymoon's over, and now you're going to see the whip being cracked in terms of fines and fees with many more organizations, if
good information. Now, what is or who is the governing body that enforces GDPR? Is it the European Council, or is it some governing body in the U.S., or some combination of both?
That is a great question. And, you know, the listeners to this podcast will think, boy, that Greg Johnson, he's so smart. He has all the answers. Well, the reality is I didn't. I know enough about GDPR and data protection in my role as, you know, the CEO of a cyber corporation. I know enough to be dangerous, but I've actually had to do quite a bit of research for this. My friend Matt Sorensen, as I mentioned before, could probably, you know, as a cyber privacy lawyer, could rattle off many more things than I could, a lot of data, but I actually had to do a lot of research. And, you know, that was one of the questions that I asked is, so if the EU is really a consortium of independent states, who manages, who governs this thing? Found some interesting things, Robbie. So first of all, Articles 51 through 59, and by the way, GDPR is complex. It's comprised of about 99 articles. And those articles touch not just cybersecurity, but the legal community as well. In other words, legal principles of consent and, you know, the right to be forgotten and so forth. So anyway, Articles 51 through 59 require that each EU member state designate an independent public authority to be responsible for the monitoring and application of GDPR and addressing their own non-compliance, enforcement, et cetera. And so, you know, depending on whether a breach of private information is in Belgium or in the UK or wherever, it will depend on the governing body. Probably the one, though, that you're going to hear the most from, of course, is the juggernaut of at least currently of the EU economy. And who knows what Brexit will do to all this, but I suspect that it will not take the UK out of participation in GDPR, because the principles still apply, and I think they'll still participate. But that is the ICO. So that's something for your listeners to realize, is the ICO, or the Information Commissioner's Office, is the UK's independent authority, which was set up to uphold the information rights in the public interest. So, you know, you look at it, and a lot of the in fact, I think later on in the podcast we're going to talk about fines and who's been fined, and you'll find that most of those fines are going to come from the ICO. Their main office is in Wimslow, Cheshire, in England, but they also have offices in Scotland and in Wales, and also in Northern Ireland. And you look at their management board, and it's quite a who's who of privacy, legal, cybersecurity experts throughout the world. So anyway, I would say, Ravi, that the main enforcement body, the one that you're going to hear of in the news, the one that's going to wield the biggest hammer, will be the UK's Information Commissioner's Office.
Okay. Now, just a side question. What will be the impacts on GDPR? You kind of alluded to this, if Brexit does happen.
Well, so I think maybe there's a couple of questions there, but let's start with Brexit. Ravi, is your question that what impact will Brexit have on GDPR?
Yeah, the impacts of Brexit on the GDPR. Now, obviously, you said that there are governing bodies in England, but if Britain does finally officially break away from the EU, what will the impacts of that be on the GDPR legislation and those companies that have to abide by them?
Right. And you know, I don't have a crystal ball, so honestly, I can't say definitively what will happen. But I don't suspect that the economic disentanglement that really is what Brexit represents will necessarily disentangle them from GDPR. I think, if anything, the UK would keep the GDPR and manage and enforce it themselves, which essentially they're doing anyway, and would probably, you know, it's like being a member of the UN. You're going to be interested in the welfare of your neighbor, and you're going to participate. And as the GDPR is upgraded and updated, there will be conferences, there will be changes, and I think most of the countries that currently comprise the EU or are subscribing to the GDPR principles will continue to participate, contribute, and govern their countries by the General Data Protection Regulation. So I can't see that there will be a tremendous impact other than the UK may just take over their component of it, but it will still continue to be enforced and publicized as is.
Okay. Now, I think this is probably going to be the biggest question for everybody. Like, what are the fines? Suppose a company is found not in compliance with GDPR. What are some of the fines that can be faced? Because I've been reading stuff about GDPR, and on and off, I've been writing about them in my blog postings, but I've read somewhere where it's pretty substantial. It can be up to, like, I think 4% of net profit of a company, if I'm correct.
Well, it's even bigger than that, Robbie. So,
oh, really?
The bottom line is that the fine, just to cut to the chase here, can be up to 20 million euros, or, and here's where the 4% comes in, up to 4% of annual worldwide, get this, revenue. not net profits, but revenue. So, you know, imagine, you know, round numbers, if you're a company that's doing $100 million in annual revenue and you get fined, that's $4 million. that's a lot of money. And so it's not just what you're making in the EU, it's what you're making worldwide. And so it's kind of the whichever is greater as well. So that figure I just gave, 4 million or 20 million, they're going to go with whichever is greater. So let me read that again for our readers. A fine of up to 20 million euros or up to 4% of annual worldwide revenue or turnover of the preceding financial year in case of an enterprise, whichever is greater. So, it can be big. Now, the sanctions can be imposed on what you call either data controllers or data processors. And so there is a differential. And I kind of look at that as, you know, do you deal directly with the consumer? If so, you're a controller, you control their data. A processor would be, you know, like we mentioned Amazon before. They're a service provider that's providing either infrastructure or storage, or there may be SaaS companies that are going to touch that data and ingest it and whatever. They would be a processor. So both of those organizations then become in scope, either as a controller or a processor, for potential noncompliance. So what happens is there's a warning in writing in the cases of first and non-intentional compliance. So it's kind of like, Robbie, when I don't know if you've ever gotten pulled over and you thought, oh, crap, I can't afford a $300 speeding ticket today. And the officer comes up and he's in a good mood and he says, hey, well, Mr. Daw, you were going 20 miles over the speed limit. I know it's 3 a.m. and it's late and there's nobody else on the road, so I'm just going to give you a warning today, but next time won't be so lenient. And you're going, thank you, officer, thank you, right? So, you know, fortunately, sometimes I've gotten a few warnings in my day, and I'm always grateful for them. But that's the good news is that, you know, if let's say you're a smaller company and there is some kind of a breach, you're not just going to get slapped with a $20 million euro fine. And I have to mitigate that too. I mean, obviously they're not going to fine a $20 million euro fee on a company that only did 5 million in revenue. You know, you will get a warning and then you will probably be directed by the EU Commission. In this case, if it's in the UK, the ICO that was aforementioned, to do a data protection audit. So they'll want to know what are the controls and the measures that you're taking to protect that data, and they'll probably want to audit your policies and so forth. And therefore, you know, being able to demonstrate that you've gone through a GDPR audit potentially could mitigate some of those fines as well. So anyway, there's that. And then I've got a note here on you're going to have to demonstrate that what measures you either will take or are taking to restrict access to data, including any applicable, definitive, and permanent bans. So there may need to be a change. Either way, if you get a warning, there's probably going to be an audit. There's probably going to be a need to demonstrate what you're doing going forward and how that's going to affect the data of these European citizens going forward. Now, that kind of leads to what would be your next question, which is, so why do I care? Well, let's say that I get fined by the European Union, but I'm a U.S. company. You know, I'm a U.S. citizen. My employees are U.S. citizens. How are they going to enforce that? I'm not going to pay that. Well, here's the reality of it, Ravi. The ICO, for example, in the U.K., can block and ban all transactions to its citizens, right? So yeah, they can't. They may not be able to have a reach that comes over here and stops your business, like for example the Federal Trade Commission would in the U.S. or with the California Privacy Act, different regulatory bodies in California, licensing bodies, et cetera. But you know, I guess you have to weigh the value of your European business against the loss of that business. If you're only doing $5,000 a year in Europe and you're a smaller business and you know, $100 million of it comes from the U.S., then maybe that organization, you know, doesn't care in the balance. But certainly, you know, the ICO and other commissions in the EU have the power to effectively stop your business transactions in the EU. So that's certainly something that I think a lot of U.S. companies haven't completely considered, is that, hey, yeah, you know, they can't come over and stop our business, but they can certainly decrease or cut off our revenue abroad. If that makes sense.
Now, just two follow-up questions here. One, suppose company XYZ has been fined to pay 4% of their revenues. Is there an appeals process that they can, the company XYZ can do first before they pay any amount? And two, can you give us some examples of companies that have been hit with GDPR fines? Just to kind of show
yes
the real gravity of the situation.
Yeah, there is, and you know, I'm not as familiar with the appeals process, but you could go to the ICO and talk to their management board. You know, similar to I know of recently a company in the U.S. that went before the FTC with their lawyer and said, hey, you know, you fined us. Why did you fine us? And is there any way to appeal that? And there was a process there. And similarly with the ICO and other European Union enforcement commissions, you would be able to go before them and plead your case, similar to the ability to make a complaint. On the flip side, Robbie, if you're an EU citizen, you know, I'm looking at the ICO page right now, and there's a whole way to start a live chat, call their helpline. You can complain about the use of cookies on a website, for example, nuisance calls and messages. So similarly, there is a way to contact the commission and talk about and to appeal that process. And that's where you need a good, you know, every company, that leads to another concept here, Robbie, and that is that serious companies that are doing business in Europe really need to have a general counsel and relationships to a legal firm that specializes in data privacy. So, for example, in my role at WebCheck Security, I have a partnership with Parsons Bailey & Latimer. Parsons Bailey & Latimer is a well-known data privacy firm here in the Salt Lake City area. They have a GDPR software platform to help companies to implement the correct policies and find the policy gaps, as well as it comes with several hours of legal consulting with certified, bar certified lawyers. And there are other good firms as well. Stoll Reeves, STOEL, Stoll Reeves is another good law firm in the greater Salt Lake City area that does business all over the world and internationally. The point is, it's very important for international companies to have a relationship with a law firm that specializes in privacy law, like Parsons Bailey and Stoll Reeves. But now to your other question, there have been some pretty whopping fines. In some of the research that I've done, you'll recognize some of these. Let me just sift through these here. One of the first offenders was British Airways. Did you hear about that one, Ravi?
Yeah. I think their website was hacked into. Some obnoxiously large number of accounts were hacked into. Personal identifiable information, credit card numbers were all stolen. Yeah, that happened, I think, back in fall time last year.
Yeah, there was. Well, this particular article that I found was posted in July 9th of last year. And it and the hack actually came a lot earlier. Sometimes it's a year until the offenses are found. But British Airways, they were slapped with a proposed fine of £183 million sterling. That's a lot of money, Robbie. And it was, of course, for breach of customer data. So you're right. Their systems were hacked into. And then here's another one. So British Airways, the very next day, they announced that the ICO was going to impose a £99 million sterling fine on Marriott for similar purposes. In that case, the Marriott issue. Yielded approximately 339 million guest records in the EU. So, the article here that I'd heard of this and read about this in other. I don't know if those 339 million were all EU guests, but you can bet that in order for the ICO to levy that kind of a fine, there had to have been a significant portion of those records that were European. Data as well. So those are two of the big ones. And of course, we've talked a little bit about Facebook and Facebook was also fined. I don't have that information here and I don't remember off the top of my head, but I guess that, well, actually here it is, at least the Cambridge Analytica thing, Facebook was fined £500,000. So yeah, half a million dollars, pounds sterling, for their role in providing Cambridge Analytica the data that was mismanaged and so forth. So there are three biggies and some rather large fines. Marriott, British Airways, Facebook, and everybody's heard of those. Now, this is similar to the PCI days. When I started in the cybersecurity industry back in 2006, PCI was just becoming a thing. It had been spun off as its own counsel and credit card data in those earlier days of you know, PCI and internet monitoring and cybersecurity. Credit cards were being stolen at an appalling rate, right? You know, you hear of the Target. We always often hear it talk about the Target breach and some of the early processors that the Heartland breach and so forth. And so you heard about the large ones, but what you didn't hear about were the smaller ones. I was involved with a good company called Security Metrics early on, and I was consulting and providing services for small merchants, large merchants, small processors, and large processors. And you know, I've used this story before, but there was the small Mexican restaurant that was fined $80,000 by MasterCard because of the loss of you know, PCI data back in the day. Well, these are the large stories. What we're not hearing are some of the smaller companies. And when I say smaller, Ravi, I mean, you know, there are companies that are, you know, maybe in between 10 million and a billion in revenue that may not make the major airwaves with regards to these fines, but you can bet that it's happening, just like it was back in the day with the small Mexican restaurant. Nobody knew about it, nobody heard about it, but it's going on. So just because British Airways and you know Marriott and Facebook are fined, it doesn't mean that you know they're going after only the bigs in the industry. That makes sense.
Wow. I still can't imagine. I mean, I don't think I'll ever come close to that kind of money in my lifetime, but still, just the amount is just unfathomable. Wow. Okay.
Well, it really is. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I tell you, when Greg's another side question here, but with Facebook, I mean, it seems like you know, they got fined, but it seems like they just don't seem to get it because every day, I go through news headlines every day, you know, in the cybersecurity across, you know, four or five different portals. And there's always something on Facebook coming out. You know, they violated this, they've done that. It's just, I mean, do some of these companies really even get it after they've been fined? Or just because they have so much out sheets that they just don't care? You know?
Well, you know, this is personal opinion, but you can bet that Lloyd's of London is doing a lot of hefty business crafting privacy breach insurance policy. So,
yeah, oh yeah.
You know, it's just a best practice for any organization to have a relationship, whether it's retainer or even just having a discussion with a law firm to know how to be able to reach out to protect themselves in terms of litigation, but also along with that, to have a cybersecurity policy. And there are a lot of companies that sell cybersecurity policies, but to do a little diligence, you find that there are very specific companies, like AIG is one that comes to mind, Hays Insurance, and those are two of maybe 100, but there are thousands of insurance companies, and they all claim, well, we can underwrite a cybersecurity policy, but not all of those policies are created equal. As you know, it's kind of like your car insurance. You know, sometimes you get in an accident, and if it's Podunk Diddly Inc. insurance, sometimes it takes a long time to get the payout and to get any information versus Allstate, which is, you know, maybe more expensive, but their customer service is through the roof and they pay quickly. So it's, you know, that's just a kind of a personal insight, maybe a side note, but you got to bet, Ravi, that it's not that the companies don't get it. But we live in a litigious society. We live in a dangerous society. You can put into place all of the cyber controls in the world, and there still may be issues. So you just got to have backup. You got to have an insurance policy for cyber, and you got to have a relationship with the legal organization. So, but good insight on your part.
Thanks. Now, can we kind of just offshoot a little bit and talk about the CCPA, the California Privacy Act? What do you know about it? And And is it similar to the GDPR? Are the penalties just as steep? Can you tell us, like, what you know about it and what the similarities and some of the dissimilarities are?
Yeah, there are some similarities. I am not, in doing this webinar, I'm kind of a cybersecurity generalist. I own a successful world-class pen testing company. I also serve as the vice president of sales and on the executive team for Secuvant, which is a SOC, a security operations center, and they also do some risk program management with companies across the U.S. So I'm a generalist. I know. So really, you know, I'm not an expert in CCPA, but I'll tell you, I with the aforementioned partner Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, I went to a really enlightening presentation about a month ago that was given by the president or the CEO of what they call Parsons Bailey Labs. Now that's the organization that is owned by Parsons Bailey, the law firm, and that owns the GDPR software platform that's been so successful in many organizations that I deal with, both as WebCheck and with Secuvant, the other company that I work with. And it was fascinating to hear Tomu Johnson, the CEO of this Parsons Bailey Labs, talk about the CCPA. It's, in fact, an expertise of his. He may be one of the foremost experts on it in the U.S. And there were several principles of CCPA that really kind of jumped to the forefront. And one of them, and this is kind of a big difference between CCPA and GDPR, GDPR is really designed to protect the data of EU citizens. CCPA is designed for litigation. Now, does that kind of get the hair on the back of your neck to stand up a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
When you think about, you think about what company doesn't do business with California, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the U.S. And as you know, California is a very a code-heavy state. And it's, you know, the opinion of many of our lawyer friends that CCPA is really designed for people to bring lawsuits against big companies and to win. So you think about the implications of that. Let me give you an example. At Secuvant, recently they did some what we call data privacy mapping exercises to help certain companies with these regulations, CCPA, GDPR, to understand their inflows and outgoes. Where's the privacy data coming from? Where does it come? Where does it persist? Where is that data? And then obviously that helps them to identify what they need to do to protect that data. It can be a very important exercise. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. The important thing is that, you know, these companies realize that they can be heavily litigated against if they don't take those kinds of actions. And that's the one thing I learned in the CCPA, and many of the principles are the same. You know, you've got consent, you've got website cookie notices that you have to put on your website, you know, what kind of data you're collecting. The citizens of California have to, or not have to, but have the right, similar to GDPR, to get a report on what data that is being collected on them from a particular company, whether or not that data is being sold. So it's based on what Tomu told us, it's almost more restrictive than GDPR. I noticed there are some very clear applicability bars, Ravi. So, for example, if you're an organization and you don't have $10 million in revenue, you really don't CCPA is really not going to apply. So there are some, you know, for small businesses, I wouldn't ignore GDPR because I'm sure some enterprising litigious lawyer could, you know, use the act to maybe win a case. And so I don't think it can be ignored, but I do see that CCPA is not really geared towards small business, but it's geared towards medium enterprise and larger in order to fine and sue and win and pay out California citizens who've had their data breached. So, you know, if you were to sum it up another way, Ravi, I would say that CCPA is designed to create massive class action lawsuits against Facebook and others, and to be able to win those lawsuits.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now let's get back to GDPR again. What are the major tenets of GDPR? Like, what are the major components of it?
Great question. And you know, again, in talking about these, CCPA has many similar things. But here they are. Now I'll go on for a few minutes. You can just stop me and ask questions. But basically, there are, as I mentioned, 99 articles. We won't go through all those today on this podcast, obviously. There are six. Let's do it. Hey, but there are six main principles, and then there are some basic data subject rights. So if I may, I'll go over some of those just briefly. Principle one is lawfulness, fairness, and transparency. So, you know, you can construe these in a number of ways. And again, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to pretend to interpret all of these. But the data needs to be handled in ways that are lawful, fair, and transparent. And the transparency is the key part. What are you doing with my data? What are you collecting? Where does it go? Who are you selling it to? And those kinds of things. Number two, purpose limitation. What that means is you better have a darn good reason, Ravi, for collecting my data. And so the GDPR regulations, for example, let's, you know, back in the old days, not so much anymore. You'll notice in the U.S. for lots of different applications, you need your Social Security number. That's still true of government documents. But I've noticed over the past couple of years where Social Security numbers were asked for other purposes, those are no longer being asked for. And it's the same principle here, is if you don't need to gather my personal data, then don't, right? That's the other principle. Principle number three is data minimization. That may be similar to purpose limitation, but it's different in that, you know, maybe I need your name, your address, but do I need your email as well and your phone number? So organizations have to take a hard look at what information they're gathering and whether or not they need all of the information they think they need, bottom line. The other principle, believe it or not, principle number four, is accuracy. In other words, gathering the right information. If somebody has designated you as a Jew, and this is a real, if your religious affiliation is Jewish and you're actually a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the Baptists or whatever, that's a breach of the principle because somebody has gathered data about you that's not accurate. So the data that is gathered, limited and minimized, has to be accurate. The fifth principle has to do with storage. So you think about records management and, you know, boxes and boxes stored in warehouse of, well, that doesn't happen anymore. If I only need, Ravi, your data for 1 year, and let's say you're here's an example. I subscribe to Apple Music and Kindle and other things. And if I cancel those subscriptions now to comply with GDPR and CCPA, they need to delete my records. You know, they don't have to delete the financial information, but it has to be anonymized. So anonymization and pseudonymization is another principle down the road. But as far as the main principle, it's storage limitation. And then finally, number six is integrity and confidentiality. So integrity is where the whole cyber world and cyber controls comes into play. That data needs to be protected, and there need to be processes in place that limit how that data is given out, if that makes sense. So those are the six main principles. The basic subject rights. So you, Ravi, as let's say you're a European Union citizen, and you have the right to be informed when your data is collected, number one. You have the right to object to that data collection. You have the right to access the data they've collected. You have the right to challenge that data and change it. That has to do with that accuracy principle. You have the right to transfer that data easily between any processors, and you have the right to be forgotten, which means that you no longer want to do business with that company. You can demand that they erase your data, and they have to be able to do that. Make sense?
Yep.
So those are the, you know, at a high level, you know, you look at those 99 articles, that's what they are. It's the six main principles, the basic data subject rights, and then there's also consent principles. So I'll just go over those quickly. For example, there's an unambiguous or implied consent for non-sensitive information. That's your social media stuff, your business telephone numbers. But then there's explicit consent, you know, for the medical records, racial or ethnic origin, religious affiliation. There are certain things that companies now have to say, hey, we need this data. Do you give your consent? And before they can take it, you have to give it, right? Versus the other implied consent, which if you want to, you know, you're logging onto Instagram or you're giving a business your telephone number, they don't have to ask for your consent. It's kind of common sense anyway. You're giving them your telephone number. But for this other stuff, you know, you're going to have to check a box, or they may say, now for purposes, Ravi, of this call recording and to comply with GDPR, do you allow us to receive your medical records and, you know, all of this data? And you have to say yes. So, you know, there are those principles as well. So basically, in summary, six main principles, basic data rights that you have, and then as a business, you have to know what consent you need to ask for and when it's implied. So that's just a very high level.
Now, is there a website if somebody really, really wanted to dig into all this detail, you know, that they actually have a whole entire legislation spelled out verbatim, or some download a PDF or PDFs or something? Do they have a website?
There are, and we can probably make this available on your website after the podcast. But if you go to the ICO.org.uk, which is the Internet Information Commissioner's Office, that's probably going to be one of the foremost sources for GDPR information. And I notice on the site there, it talks about your rights, whether or not an organization needs consent, the guide to data protection, the actual regulation itself. So that is a great site. If you Google GDPR, you're going to get a whole bunch of companies coming up that do GDPR audits and GDPR services, cybersecurity services. But, you know, probably going to ICO.org.uk is going to be one of the best sources of data. And one thing I noticed, Ravi, it says data protection and Brexit. They even have a whole page on that. So your listeners can look at that later on.
Cool. Awesome. Now, I just kind of want to get back to CCP, right? I just had a side question. Now, is the CCP going to have worldwide implications as well? Like, for example, my company, the ASC Cybersecurity Group, I have been in Austin, Texas, and, you know, I'm really out of Illinois. I don't have any business in California. Could I still be impacted by the CCPA directly?
That's a great question, Ravi. And, you know, if your business services data or companies that do collect or are responsible for California citizens' data. So again, remember, you know, you're really only in compliance if you're, you know, above, and I think this is a threshold, $10 million, and there are some other stipulations, and that a certain percentage of your business is coming from California. If that doesn't apply, then no, you're not in the space for that. However, again, okay. think of, and I've used the example of Amazon, AWS, their web services, that, you know, the foremost provider of cloud storage and virtual server services in the world. But let's bring it down to a smaller level. There are a lot of private cloud providers. For example, here in Utah, there's a great one called FiberNet. They're a smaller company. They're a fraction the size of Amazon. They provide a great, you know, storage, colocation, and other services. So what happens, Ravi, if their service leads to a data breach of a customer of theirs that is servicing California customers? Now there's an implication for CCPA. So, you know, probably for you, let's say you have a registration list of thousands and thousands of California podcast listeners that you reach out to and email every month, and maybe now you're in scope. But again, it has to do with revenue. It has to do with how many customers you touch in the state of California. And, you know, if A or B doesn't apply, then it, or you're not servicing data that of other companies as a service provider, then it's not going to apply to you.
Okay. Now, can you go over into the trends in the technology that will help GDPR? I think one item that you want to talk about is the tokenization.
Yeah, you know, back in the PCI days, one of the things that saved small merchants was the ability not to store credit card data with a process called tokenization. And of course, that means that rather than storing the actual card data, you're just storing a token that refers to the actual record, which is held by and safely transmitted and stored and encrypted by another third-party service provider. I've recently learned that this is becoming a practice for PII as well, or personally identifiable information, and you could extend that to PHI. For example, Ravi, there is a vendor called Bluefin Payment Systems. And Bluefin, I learned recently, has implemented a tokenization technology that they're coming out with for privacy data. And I think that's revolutionary. So, again, back to the example I used previously of you, and let's say you're keeping a database of, say, podcast listeners or subscribers to you know, your website or whatever it is, you can actually now have access to that data, go out and get it for mail outs or whatever, but you don't have to store it and be responsible for it on your site anymore, because Bluefin now will store that data only as tokens on your side, and then when you want to retrieve it, it brings it out from their secure storage vault, which is encrypted, etc. And so I've learned that tokenization, it's not just for the credit card industry anymore. It is for all privacy data everywhere. So it's not just Bluefin that's coming out with this technology, but I think the trend will be in 2020, as you'll see a number of different technology providers that will offer to store sensitive data in a way that offloads it from your systems and onto theirs, but yet you still have access to it by means of a token, if that makes sense. So you think of the implications for, you know, healthcare providers or all kinds of services where, you know, California residents might be one of their large populations of clients. That business can offload the liability to Bluefin or other providers because they're implementing this technology. If that makes sense. Any questions about that, Ravi, or thoughts?
No. That kind of comes to our, as we wrap up the show here, like to your final recommendations. Obviously, you've been a pen tester for a long time. Now, what do you recommend for companies, small, the SMBs or the, Fortune 100 companies, other companies in between? What can they do for data protection and the steps to be taken, so they're not fined by the GDPR? I mean, is pen testing going to be a big factor into that? Can you kind of elaborate more on this?
Sure. Let me start first by kind of prioritizing, where a large organization should go. And I say large organization, that can include a medium or a middle organization. Obviously, small business, Ravi, isn't really going to apply to CCPA and probably even less to GDPR. But organizations that do business or service businesses that do business and so therefore touch the data with the EU or California, obviously they're going to have to take certain steps. One of those is to do a GDPR assessment. And that comes in a number of different forms. A lot of law offices will do assessments, but it's kind of focused more on the legal policy side. And do you have X, Y, or Z implemented? What lawyers or legal firms don't do well is to really recommend the data privacy controls or the data security controls that are surrounding the actual protection of that data. So I find that really there needs to be a partnership between an assessment organization and a law firm. So I would recommend that any serious organization that's in scope for GDPR or CCPA get an assessment. And there are a number of recommendations for that. I know that one company out of Tampa, Align, does a fantastic job with privacy assessments. I also, with WebCheck Security, my company have access through partnership to a number of different platforms that can help with understanding where the organization is using a self-assessment type of a technology, and then educating all employees on the Privacy Act. And then you mentioned penetration testing, and it, really the only cybersecurity, I should say, is multifaceted and it's multi-layered. So penetration test isn't cybersecurity; it's just one step. But I will say that it is one of the true ways to understand how easy it is to hack into your network by finding with a certified, ethical, benevolent engineer versus a bad actor, by finding those weak spots, the low-hanging fruit, things that may be serious or even of informational knowledge, but given enough time, hackers can hack just about anything. So you want to find out where those vulnerabilities are, and that's what a penetration test is designed to do. A good penetration test may only cost $5,000 for a smaller organization. It may cost 20 or 50 grand for a larger organization and lots of targets and several web applications and 500 internal IPs and a number of different locations. But you consider that versus a $20 million euro fine, because bad actors were able to dwell in the system for over 180 days and find the databases and breach them. It's a small price to pay, right? So I would say that would be the order of operations, is to get an assessment, find out where the holes in the policies are and the procedures and the process, get a data mapping engagement, such as what Secuvant does, and then get a penetration test from a world-class pen tester like WebCheck that does
Awesome.
That has certified engineers, experienced engineers, and fortunately they're benevolent, so they're on your side.
That's awesome. Just one last question, Greg, before we wrap up the show. Do you think we're going to see more legislations like GDPR kind of mushroom out in 2020? Or do you think it's going to be it for a while? Or because everybody's so hot and heavy now about cybersecurity, risk insurance, and this and that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, you know, I asked my lawyer friend Tomu from Parsons Bailey that very question. And there are privacy laws currently on the books in many different states. That's not something I actually researched in terms of what states are doing it, but I know according to Tomu that there are several in our good union that are considering privacy legislation. You know, a lot of people would say, well, it would seem to me like the U.S. government will take this under their wing now, and now that you have GDPR and CCPA, which are big catalysts. But you and I both know that the current kind of partisan government that we have and some of the infighting, that's not going to happen for a long time. It's not even something that's being currently talked about seriously in terms of legislation and bills being brought to the table. So I suspect it's going to be easier for individual states to pass their own privacy laws. And what a lot of them will do is they will take the California Consumer Privacy Act and they'll basically duplicate it and then customize it for some of their own citizens. Some may have higher fees. The state of New York, for example, may put into play higher, in some cases, fees and fines and other requirements, depending on the type of business that you are. And then smaller, you know, more rural states like Vermont may have a much cut down version of that. But I suspect you will see in 2020 at least half a dozen other states, Utah being one of them, that will at least consider in this legislative year privacy regulations and legislation.
Okay. Well, Greg, we thank you for your time this evening here and for your wonderful insights on GDPR. It's a lot more, I guess, gargantuan, mammoth, and really complex in size than I really realized. We look forward to having you again in the future here in Q1, and perhaps maybe next time we can talk about the 99 sections of GDPR, huh?
We'll get my friend Tom
I don't
on
know.
for that.
Okay, well, maybe we could do something more like that down the road here. But once again, thanks for your time, Greg, and have a happy and wonderful new year, okay?
Always a pleasure, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.